Okay. So this is an interview with a absolutely legendary figure in the steroid and bodybuilding community. I don't know how many people are into this kind of thing. I've always been tangentially interested in it because I see it as this sort of alternate universe of all of the things that I'm interested in. The steroid world has its own gray market, its own research chemicals, its own clandestine chemists, its own forums, its own culture of self-experimentation. It really has all of that, but toward an end that has nothing to do with psychoactivity. So it's something I've kind of watched curiously from a distance and tried to understand, but I don't really know all that much about anabolic steroids or SARMs or other performance-enhancing drugs, which is a vague catch-all term for drugs that are used typically by athletes, although you could have a performance-enhancing drug for any kind of performance. But yes, typically drugs that are used by athletes to enhance their ability to perform. It's my basic understanding that steroids at one time were very normal. They did not have the stigma attached to them that they currently do, right? Arnold Schwarzenegger has spoken openly about his use of Dianabol during his youth. And at one time, it was just kind of normal. And then by the time I was in high school, it was actually, not only did I not know anyone that did it, it was kind of unthinkable. It was sort of like one of those things that you encounter in DARE, like barbiturates or GHB, that has this kind of dated feel that seems different from whatever social niche you truly occupy. I mean, I'm sure that in some places there are teenagers that use steroids. I'm sure it is the case. Maybe it's just because I didn't go to an especially athletic school, but I didn't know anyone that was doing it. I didn't know anyone that knew anyone that was doing it. It just didn't really exist at all for me as a possibility. As I got older, I met a couple of people that had dabbled with it, and then there was the emergence of the SARMs industry. SARMs is an acronym that stands for Selective Androgen Receptor Modulators. And these are basically steroids that in most, but not all instances, are not chemically speaking steroids, meaning they don't have the four fused rings that typifies a classical steroid. Often these are compounds that are pharmacologically similar to testosterone, but chemically, structurally unrelated to testosterone. Watching the steroid world from a distance has been constructive because it gives me some empathy and some understanding for the way I assume normal people feel about psychoactive drugs. So someone will write me a message and they'll say, is psilocybin going to give me a heart attack? I'm reading conflicting things. I don't know what to trust. And I think, oh, come on. Obviously, it's not potently cardiotoxic, right? But then you look on Reddit or something and you can find some thread where somebody will be warning somebody saying that 4-fluoroamphetamine carries perichloroamphetamine type toxicity, or that 2,5-CNBOME has some kind of unique special toxicity, or you have to be extra worried about some bizarre steroidal component of Hawaiian baby Woodrow seeds, right? There's huge amounts of essentially bro science, maybe without the bros, but you have a vacuum for any kind of conventional scientific wisdom and people on forums constructing their own folk pharmacology, their own folk toxicology to inform each other about how best to use these things, what is safe, what is dangerous. And again, you have all the same problems. You have people reporting on substances that they have not analytically confirmed in any way. So somebody might be saying, oh, I think that oxandrolone doesn't work, but who's to say that they're even using oxandrolone? And on top of that, like the world of psychoactive drugs, you have substances that are potentially dangerous, but ironing out what is dangerous and under what circumstances and how to mitigate those dangers is really difficult and requires an enormous amount of knowledge. And looking at the world of anabolic steroids has given me a perspective on that where I think, okay, now I understand a little bit more why somebody might be reluctant to try 2CE or something like that. Because for me, I can look at that and I can think, okay, these are the reasons why I think this is unlikely to pose a serious threat to long-term health, right? It's been used by a large number of people without incident. It doesn't have any structural motifs that are suggestive of high reactivity in the body, like an acid chloride or some kind of perfluorinated substituent that might make it linger for absurdly long periods of time, or substitution pattern that's associated with neurotoxicity or anything like that, right? But those are all nuanced assessments that I can make as a result of having looked at structurally related compounds for years. And then when I look at some steroid, it's really hard for me to say, okay, is oxandrolone better than testosterone? If so, why? And what about tendon toxicity? And what about, is it going to cause lowering of my HDL levels? Is it going to damage my testicles? I don't know, you know. Anyway, so there's that. But the other side is that there also, of course, is a direct connection with the world of psychoactive drugs, because in the realm of pre-workout products, which as I understand it, are products that almost always are a stimulant of some kind. Maybe it's a combination of creatine and branched chain amino acids, but it seems like they often contain a stimulant. And one of the major stimulants that was a component of these pre-workout blends was called DMAA, or methylhexanamine. And this used to be in tons of products. A friend of mine used to work at a GNC-type health food store, and everything had DMAA in it. It was just kind of it was like caffeine. You just put it in every product to give it a little extra kick. And I remember at that same time that there was a product called Craze that we talk about later, and there used to be lines out the door of people wanting to buy Craze. It was so popular. People couldn't get enough of it, and it was good for working out, but it was also just an amazing stimulant. And the reason was because it contained alpha N-diethylphenethylamine, which was being sold as a extract of the Chinese orchid Dendrobium nobile, but some kind of funny business had happened in the supply chain, and this drug was introduced to the supposed orchid extract. I actually interviewed the proprietor of Craze, and I would love to either release that past interview or maybe even interview him again for the podcast, because that is a wild story. I couldn't make sense of it, but this is just part of this world of weird supplements, bodybuilding, performance-enhancing drugs, and Patrick Arnold is, without question, the greatest living expert on this. So the other thing that I think is kind of sad and maybe slightly unfortunate about Patrick Arnold is he seems so down on himself about this felony conviction. And it reminds me of talking to someone like Steve Gill or a number of other chemists that I've known that have gotten felony convictions, where they seem to think this is truly the end of their career. And maybe I don't know, because I don't know what it's like to be in that position, but I'm sure people would understand. I mean, I can't imagine that anyone would truly hold this against him. So if anyone listening to this is, looking for a chemist, Patrick Arnold is a brilliant guy, and apparently he's looking for work at the moment as well. Anyway, I think this is an amazing conversation. I've wanted to talk to Patrick Arnold for years, and I certainly learned a lot, and I hope you do as well. It's well known that the cannabis plant contains a wide variety of fascinating phytochemicals. It's one of the most studied plants in the world. And so I'm always amazed when researchers discover new compounds in cannabis. What was especially amazing is that in 2019, a group of researchers in Italy found a new cannabinoid called THCP that is structurally very similar to THC, but it has a 7-carbon chain instead of a 5-carbon chain. The extension of that chain gives THCP much greater potency. So at the CB1 receptor, which is responsible for the stoning effects of THC, THCP binds with 33 times higher affinity, making it the strongest known phytocannabinoid. I thought that this would remain an obscure scientific curiosity, and I was amazed to find that within 3 years of its discovery, techniques had been developed to industrially produce THCP from hemp. I saw that CannaClear.com was selling it. I independently ordered a sample, analyzed it via NMR, and found that the material was bona fide. So if you are interested in THCP, Delta-8 THC, HHC, or any other unusual phytocannabinoids, go to CannaClear.com. All of their materials are third-party tested for quality and compliance, and if you use the code Hamilton, you will get 15% off any purchases. Thank you, CannaClear. This podcast is also brought to you by Lucy Nicotine, a company that makes nicotine pouches, nicotine gum, and nicotine lozenges. I particularly enjoy the apple ice-flavored nicotine pouch. It is a refreshing and well-formulated product. If you don't already use nicotine products, I recommend you don't begin. They're habit-forming. But if you do, I think this is the finest nicotine product on the market. Thank you, Lucy. This podcast is also brought to you by Matcha.com. Grab a traditional matcha bowl or your favorite mug and enjoy a hot cup of matcha first thing in the morning. I don't drink coffee, but I think matcha is a wonderful way to start the day. It contains L-theanine, it contains caffeine, which is what I'm most interested in, and it has all sorts of purported health benefits. Matcha.com was founded by psychedelic pioneer Dr. Andrew Weil. All of their matcha is imported from Japan and third-party tested for heavy metals. It's delicious, probably healthy, and certainly stimulating. So enjoy a cup of matcha from matcha.com. So I've been hearing about your work for years. You're obviously a legend in the bodybuilding community. And I have always been really interested in bodybuilders because they represent this almost alternate universe of the typical psychoactive drug world. But it's like often a totally different scene, but you have all the same things happening where you have a gray market, you have chemists that are developing novel compounds, you have people that are self-experimenting, you have the bro science people on forums explaining why something is or is not toxic or beneficial. And it's almost its own ecosystem that I've watched from a distance and thought, wow, that's really interesting. But it also is something that I simply do not know enough about to have been comfortable personally experimenting with any of these compounds. So I feel like I'm fascinated by it, but also profoundly unknowledgeable. And I would love to talk with you, of course, about the history of your work. But I think as like a maybe a starting point, it would be interesting to talk about the history of anabolic steroids, how that began, how we went from the early culture where I think, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger was using Dianabol and it was permissible. And I think it was considered okay for athletes to do that and how things evolved. So could you give a kind of a brief historical overview of anabolic steroids and how they've developed over the last century or so?
Sure. Anabolic steroids, well, testosterone was discovered in 1935 by a chemist that extracted it from a very large amount of bull testicles. And he got maybe a few milligrams from it. And using the analytical chemical technology back then, they were able to characterize it and its chemical structure. And shortly thereafter, I think it was a chemist called Butenandt. A lot of these guys were German. Back then, German used to be the epicenter of chemistry, and chemical journals were all in German back then. And a lot of this early research was done by German chemists. And he administered it to animals, and he realized that it had an effect upon secondary sexual glands and development, and also an anabolic effect, which in their definition was the growth of skeletal muscle. At that point in time, they differentiated two distinct effects of testosterone, one being an effect they called androgenic, which would be effects that were outside of muscle growth. And they used rats to do an assay, and they used the ventral prostate, the seminal, and the seminal vesicles as a gauge for anabolic or androgenic activity. And then they, of course, used the muscles, the levator ani muscle, to determine anabolic activity. Now, I don't mean to get too much into the details, but that gives you a foundation of what was later on to become the development of anabolic steroids. Now, anabolic steroids, by definition, are derivatives of testosterone with decreased androgenic activity and proportional-wise, more anabolic activity, either of the ratio being in favor of anabolic or actually having more anabolic activity than testosterone. And so derivatives such as nandrolone and other ones were developed, plus oral derivatives were developed because testosterone is not orally active. Now, I'll just leave it there. It's the background from which the science of anabolic steroids was later on perfected.
And so when something new is discovered in medicine, there's often this hope that it will solve humanity's problems. And I don't know much about this early era, but I can imagine there was tremendous excitement when you find that there are these chemicals, and if you introduce them into the human body, suddenly people become much stronger. I mean, was the idea then that these would be exclusively used to treat diseases of muscle wasting or things like that? Or was there an idea from the very beginning that maybe healthy people could take these things and get extremely muscular beyond anything that would be possible under normal circumstances?
No, all the literature I've read, there were two main focuses, and that one was to treat men who lost muscle and lost virility, or I forgot they had a certain term, which is now archaic, but basically the male drive, the virility, I guess you can call it. And that would be given to men as they got older. And a lot of, there was a market early on for that. And then also there was a market or research directed at finding derivatives that were more purely anabolic. And those were meant to cure diseases of muscle wasting due to cancer or due to other pathologies where the body weight would go down, and often survival was dependent upon muscle mass. And these medications, they wanted to give them to children and women as in addition to men. So it was very important to minimize the androgenic or virilizing male enhancement effects of these compounds. However, they never were able to get something that was didn't have some component of androgenic activity associated with them.
And I'm kind of curious about tracing how people become afraid of these things. Have you ever seen the movie Bigger Than Life by any chance?
No, I'm not familiar with it.
It's a movie from 1956 that is basically about cortisone and the school teacher who starts taking cortisone, and he goes from being a family man to a monster. Psychotic monster. It's Reefer Madness for early steroids. I mean, not even anabolic steroids in this instance, but I think it's an early instance of how you have the discovery of cortisone and people are already wringing their hands about psychiatric side effects or how these medicines must be too good to be true. So when did that cultural shift start to emerge where people started saying, well, wait a second, this is not something to play around with?
Well, anabolic steroids, they remained a pretty niche market or area of research for quite a while. And they were used in clinical settings for muscle wasting. And they were also used, testosterone was used for men that were losing their youth as an elixir, I suppose. But it wasn't until the late 50s that the use in athletics and in healthy people to gain strength and muscle mass that they couldn't using just exercise and nutrition I think the Soviets were the first ones to initiate this. And later on, the United States developed a drug called Dianabol, which is oral, and people started taking that. But it still remained kind of a subculture thing until, I think, the Olympics. It might have been the 72 Olympics, where East Germany, if the women's team, started winning an inordinate amount of gold medals or silver medals in events like swimming and track and field. And these women had distinctly masculine physiques, and some of them even had, you know, little facial hair. So that was when everyone knew that something was up, and it became a backlash. And it wasn't too long after that, I think, the IOC made anabolic steroids a prohibited substance. However, I don't know if they really tested for them until sometime in the around 80 or 84. And that's when people started to know what these were. And then I think it was in 88 when Ben Johnson was stripped of his gold medal in the 100 meters, where he broke the world record, that it really hit the mainstream media and people had a very negative view of these substances. And there was a lot of hype and a lot of misinformation regarding their toxicity, and everyone was saying this stuff will kill you. You know, these people win a gold medal and they're dead 5 years later. You know, that would be an extreme example of misinformation. But in general, people had a very negative view of these. And also, the substances started to be used by weightlifters in outside of athletics and just in gyms and in the bodybuilding world as well. They became more and more abused.
This podcast is also brought to you by the Apollo. The Apollo is a wearable bracelet or anklet, whichever you prefer, that produces a vibrating frequency that can achieve a number of different effects depending on how you set the device. It can be stimulating to wake up in the morning or relaxing at the end of the day. Sometimes I wear it while I'm sleeping. Sometimes I wear it while I'm driving. I find the effect really nice. It's sort of like strapping a purring kitten to your ankle. And I know that it sounds a little bit weird, but if you enjoy massage, if you enjoy relaxing, vibrating chairs, I think that this is in that vein of an effect. It feels really nice and calming, and it's a great way of non-pharmacologically altering your mood. This is a product that was created by a psychiatrist named Dr. David Rabin after years of research, and I think it's a really interesting device. So if you want to learn more about the Apollo, go to apolloneuro.com, and thank you for the sponsorship, Apollo.
Right. I mean, I'm friends with a bodybuilder. This guy, Stephen Watt. Do you know him by any chance?
Yeah, I know. He's the guy that's really tall.
Yeah.
He's a computer guy. I'm friends with him on Facebook.
Yeah. He's the biggest man. I think he's the biggest man I've ever known. He's like 6'8" or something, just a giant. He turns heads when he walks down the street.
I'm sure.
But I am a real ectomorph. I'm 6'1". Most of my life I've been about 120 to 130 pounds. Now I'm a little better. I'm about 140, but I've never been able to put on weight or muscle or anything. And Stephen Watt wrote to me one day and he said, I want to get you jacked. I will train you for free if you want to get ripped. And I thought, well, this is a really bizarre offer. And this guy certainly seems to know what he's talking about. So what the hell? What do I have to lose? So I started going with him to the gym and constantly sore. And I'm also just disgusted by how much food he's asking me to eat. You know, he's saying, you need to drink a gallon of milk. You need to have a jar of almond butter. You need to have this every day in addition to your normal food. And it was like, it was totally incapacitating for me to consume this quantity of food. Like I just felt sick and sore all the time. And after maybe a month of this, he saw that I wasn't really gaining any muscle mass. And he said, well, you know, what about anabolic steroids? How do you feel about that? And I said, well, you know, what about testicular atrophy? What about acne? What about hair loss? What about cholesterol dysregulation? What about infertility? All of these issues that I'd heard, you know, isn't this totally dangerous? Why? I don't think I could justify the risk of taking one of these drugs. And he said, you know, no, these are like any other class of drugs, whether it's psychedelics or cannabinoids or stimulants, where everyone has been exposed to enormous amounts of propaganda. And like any other class of drugs, if you use them responsibly and intelligently, there are safe ways to use them. You know, so he asked me to watch Bigger, Faster, Stronger and to read Muscle by Sam Fussell or Fussell, however it's pronounced, and, you know, watch Pumping Iron. And so I kind of immerse myself in this literature and come to basically the same conclusion that, yeah, there probably is a safe way to do this, but will I lose everything that I gain? I still couldn't quite justify doing a course of steroids. And I was never able to figure out whether the risk was justified or how dangerous it actually was to do these sorts of things. So my question is, you know, from the perspective of someone who doesn't know anything about this, like, are these risks overblown? I just couldn't figure it out. Like, I know that this is a broad question because this is referring to literally hundreds of different compounds with different types of activity. But do you think that there is a safe way to use anabolic steroids that will not cause, you know, testicular atrophy, infertility, all these other undesirable adverse effects?
Yes, I think this is a very fundamental question. And this question has been figured out a long time ago when people realized that if they did cycles, usually a cycle lasts anywhere from 8 to 12 weeks, and sometimes the tapered doses are tapered up, tapered down, and then they took a significant amount of time off, sometimes taking medications to help kickstart your hypothalamic pituitary testicular axis, which it regulates your endocrine function, the testosterone production, then you are going to avoid side effects. Now, effects such as cholesterol elevation, they're transient. And you really need to have your, you know, lipid metabolism or lipid dysfunction, LDL, HDL, triglycerides, total cholesterol. These things have to be, they only manifest themselves in a chronic fashion. If you have 8 weeks where your cholesterol's off, now I don't think it's going to have any effect on your cardiovascular risk in the long term. Liver toxicity is an issue. If you have a healthy liver, you are not going to see anything much more than certain elevated liver enzymes, just transaminases. And people have, I've known countless people that have taken steroids in this fashion and have gotten considerable gains and, you know, retained some of them. And they went on, they stopped using them. They're completely healthy. And there are bodybuilders in their 70s and 80s that were pro bodybuilders, and they obviously used a lot of them. Sometimes some of them still do, and they're still around. As I think, as long as they have a doctor that monitors them, a lot of these the risks can be seen quite readily in a blood test. So if you're in a condition where they are having an adverse effect upon you, you would know, and you'd be able to go off of them or minimize your dosage. But yeah, so the answer is absolutely they can be used in a fashion where you avoid any significant adverse health effects.
And when you started getting into the chemistry of steroids, had you used steroids previously, or was it your first experience steroid that you had synthesized yourself?
No, I had used steroids before, so I knew how they worked. I knew how effective they were. Yeah, I had used them before.
And when you started pursuing the chemistry, was there a question that you were trying to answer, or was there a specific steroid that you didn't have access to that you wanted? What did you feel was incomplete about the existing steroids that were circulating, or what sort of work did you think needed to be done?
I just had a lot of free time at the lab I was working with in New Jersey at, and I figured if I could make some of this stuff myself, I wouldn't have to go searching around for someone that sold them and wondering if what they sold me was actually legitimate. And so it was a process of me trying to make some of the simplest stuff and really screwing it up, and then gradually learning more and more through my errors, and then making more complicated, sophisticated steroids. And I learned a lot about synthesis that way, about how to go about how to plan a synthesis, how to track what you're doing, purification techniques. And a lot of this stuff was just, I learned it by doing it behind the back of everyone at work. So
right.
I was quite motivated. It's very good. I was very sneaky.
Right. And I don't know if you know this about me, but I'm a chemist and I pretty much exclusively work with psychoactive drugs, phenethylamines, tryptamines, things like that. And I have never done any steroid-related chemistry. So I'm very unknowledgeable about this area, but I would still love, but I'm, you know, knowledgeable about chemistry generally. So I think it would be interesting to get into the details. I mean, even on the level of, you know, most of the compounds that I work with have a basic nitrogen atom. So that is a fundamental component of how the compounds are purified. You do, you know, an acid base and then run a column on the base. Whereas that sort of chemistry is not possible with many of the steroids that I'm familiar with. Maybe there is one with a basic nitrogen, but it seems like most of the classical steroids do not have a basic nitrogen. So yeah, I mean, could you tell me a little bit about the chemistry, like generally speaking, how a steroid is made?
Well, there are no acid or carboxylate or amino groups on most all steroid hormones. However, just like with the psychedelics that you have synthesized, you have to find a suitable precursor. You don't start from something way far down the line. You find the most commercially available precursor that you can get, and then you do functional group transformations or whatever you have to do to get to your desired product. Now, in the case of steroids, there is a readily available steroid called dehydroepiandrosterone, DHEA, and that could be used as a starting material for a lot of these steroids that are known as T19 steroids, the testosterone family. Now, there's also something called the nortestosterone family, and there's other precursors for those, and there's ways to convert drugs of the progestin class into anabolic steroids. I discovered a lot of nifty ways to get to the end point in the most efficient and facile fashion possible.
And so for something like DHEA to testosterone, you're oxidizing an alcohol, but there's a double bond that needs to be shifted. Well, I mean, what kind of stuff are you doing?
DHEA to testosterone, basically what you are doing is protecting the alcohol at 3, the protecting group, then you're reducing the ketone at C17. Now, you're a chemist, so you can kind of understand this. A lot of your readers, listeners can't. But at first, there's a protection of one part of it, and then there's a reduction of the other, and then there's esterification of that reduced ketone, or which is now an alcohol. And then there's deep protection, and the reaction called the Oppenheimer oxidation, which oxidizes the hydroxylate 3 to a ketone with simultaneous shifting of the double bond to the conjugated version at 4-5 in the steroid skeleton.
We got the rectal kratom guy right off camera right now. I mean, this is what you're telling me. I don't know. That's boofing kratom. It's become a meme on the internet. This is a kratom tea product. It's not intended for boofing. Even if the pH of the human rectum is between 7 and 8 and the pKa of metrogenine is 8.1, that's just not really relevant here. This is a tea consumption in hot water. That's what it's for. That's what it should be used for. If you want this tea, you can get it at toptreeherbs.com.
So this is like a few steps.
It's kind of a pain, believe it, compared to some other syntheses. And there's also a way to make it from an androstenedione, or you can oxidize DHEA to androstenedione. Then you could do a selective reduction at 17, because the one at 3 is more sterically hindered. But it requires some very unique conditions, very low temperatures, and solvents that release the borohydride very slowly. Anyway, too technical.
So you were doing this while working in the lab. What was the official work that you were supposed to be doing during this period, or you were doing during this period?
I was making hair care polymers.
Hair care?
Polymers.
Oh, like what?
It goes into gels, hair gels, or some of them went into conditioners, specialty chemicals. And basically they're polymer reactions, and I charge a reactor and then add a free radical catalyst and every half hour or so. And that's pretty damn boring. And that gave me a lot of free time to go look stuff up. And there was a chemistry library on the floor that I worked at this company that had a whole set of chemical abstracts and had a lot of the most well-known chemistry journals as well. So I was able to get a lot of fundamental research done there. And then stuff I couldn't, journals that I didn't have, I would travel to libraries within driving distance. And this was Wayne, New Jersey. And then I would find the articles there and I'd photocopy them. And it was like a second job. It's like more of a job than my real job, actually.
And what were you thinking when you were doing this? Like, I'm going to try these substances and get swole, or like, yeah, this could be a business.
I was like, well, I'd really like to make this stuff. Maybe it's better than the other stuff. And just part of it was just the challenge of synthesizing all these things that I thought were like these wonder drugs. And a lot of these things were anabolic steroids that weren't even known to most people that were in the fitness community where they use steroids. And eventually I took that basic knowledge and went on to do what I did in the future when I got my own company
right. In
Illinois.
And just for some context, because in the world of psychoactive drugs, there is sort of a history and a culture of self-experimentation. You have chemists like Alexander Shulgin, who created a methodology for the evaluation of novel psychoactive drugs, where he would start with an absolutely minuscule dose that was, 1/100th the lowest conceivable active dose, and he would very gradually escalate. And then on top of that, once he characterized the active dose, he typically would not continue evaluation of that drug. And that's possible with psychoactive drugs because you have an immediate effect that outside of placebo is noticeable. But the same is not true for an anabolic steroid. For anybody listening to this who doesn't know, I mean, I've used oxandrolone on one occasion. I've used topical testosterone on a couple of occasions. And as far as I can tell, there is no acute effect that I would say couldn't be explained by placebo. I'm not confident that there's anything that you could tell it's working. So correct me if I'm wrong, but if you're creating a novel steroid, how would you even know that this is a good steroid? You'd have to take it daily for long periods of time, right?
There really was no way of determining its effectiveness, certainly not in the way Shulgin did. Because of what you said, there is an immediate psychoactive effect that is undeniable. And if you take a steroid, you don't feel a damn thing, and at least not for a little while. And it's my belief that if you take a lot of these steroids, you don't even go to the gym, you might not even know you're taking a damn thing. You wouldn't really feel anything. But it's in combination with going to the gym, especially if you have trained without steroids, you notice that suddenly you're getting stronger. And then that has a feedback effect upon your mind. And there could be some psychological effects directly from the steroids. However, I think those have been much overblown, but you'd really need more than one person. And you need people that would have to adhere to, similar diet and exercise regimens if you really wanted to get to quantify the results.
So this makes it seem extremely difficult, what you're doing. I mean, people will always say, oh, how could Shulgin have done this? It was so dangerous. And using his methodology, if he had rediscovered strychnine, for example, I mean, let's just assume
he could have killed himself.
No, he wouldn't have, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, but because he would have started at very, very lowest.
Yeah, he would have started at 10 micrograms. And then by the time he got up to whatever, 900 micrograms, he would have said, this stuff is making my muscles really tense. I don't think I'm going to take any more of this. And he would not have poisoned himself.
Right.
And you did not have that luxury. You didn't have the ability to make those short-term assessments. And I think this is maybe another reason that there's so much maybe bro science or folk pharmacology in the bodybuilding community, is it seems like these questions are actually harder to answer.
Well, here's something that should have been mentioned. A lot of these compounds, most of all the ones that I made, well, certainly at that time, were ones that had been synthesized by other chemists in the decades previous. Some of them never made it to market. Many of them did not, but their biological activities were noted.
Right, right.
Animal models. So you had a general idea of the relative potency of each, and you had a pretty good idea of dosage, because the dosages of anabolic they don't really go outside of certain ranges, and they are proportional to their potency. And the potency is in the literature. You can look that up. So you kind of know what dose range to take any particular steroid that you synthesized.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. So you synthesize testosterone, you start looking through old literature and resynthesizing other compounds. And I imagine that was a lot of fun. Were you exclusively working on steroids? Were you also interested in psychedelics or other things? Because I know later you got into some other areas, but from the beginning, was it almost totally a steroid oriented?
Well, I was also interested in some recreational drugs. I wasn't interested in psychedelics because I wasn't very familiar with the chemistry. And plus, a lot of the precursors were quite well controlled. And I also didn't want to get a tiny bit on my finger and then go into a months-long acid trip, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah, I never wanted to venture into that area. Although I'm very curious about the psychological benefits and the whole mystical aspect of those substances. It continues to fascinate me. However, with these steroids, there's none of that fear. And after a while, you synthesize all these things, and they're really not, one is not really that much better than the other. After a while, there are a few that stand out, but it's some of the ones that are really potent have kind of nasty side effects or a little more toxic on the liver, or they result in water retention, or they have sort of cross-reactivity with the mineral corticoid receptors, and they result in massive sodium and water retention. It makes you feel like you're going to die. So
Right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, I listened to an interview with you years ago where you mentioned that you had synthesized methadone.
Right.
Well,
when I was looking at making all kinds of recreational stuff, and I was interested in opioids. So I looked into, obviously I'm not going to make anything related to the poppy plant opiates, like, you know, morphine, because you can't get any precursors for that. However, just stuff like Demerol and methadone, these opiate being opioids that are derived from Papaver somniferum, the poppy plant, wholly synthetic opioids, yeah, you can purchase the precursors. And I found that methadone was one that where the precursors were quite readily available and cheap. And I would purchase them through my business and just forge my boss's name on the requisition form. And it was a 3 or 4 step synthesis to make methadone. And I worked at it for a while and finally succeeded, and then took way too much. And I got quite sick, actually. That's a very long half-life. That's a 36-hour half-life. So
right.
Way too much. And within half an hour, you know you took way too much. You're going to be horizontal for 3 or 4 days. And if you get up, you're going to puke. That's what happened to me the first time I tried it. Realized, okay, you got to dose a lot lower.
Right.
But that was a very terrible thing, because I ended up getting a horrible addiction to it, and I had to go to detox rehab center, and it was the worst detox you could ever imagine, really.
Yeah. No, I've always...
I had developed an incredible tolerance.
Right. Yeah. And was that the only opioid that you synthesized? You made methadone and then that...
No, just methadone, because the other ones I looked at, and they were... you know, too difficult to make. And there was one, I don't know if it was meperidine, which is Demerol, or something very similar to it. But if you screw the synthesis up, you get an isomer, which is extremely toxic. It's called MPTP. And they actually use it for experimental Parkinson's in rats. And you know the story behind MPTP?
Of course, Barry Kidston. Yeah, it's the greatest scare story of all time. I mean, it's true. Yeah.
People were taking this stuff and they were coming down, or, you know, they're locked up. Yeah, it was horrible. So,
yeah, I mean, that's...
I did try to make that once. I did have access to GC mass spec at the time. And I looked at it and I was like, clicked on a peak. And the library showed up, MP, Bethel, I forgot what it stands for, but it was MPTP. And I was like, oh shit, don't touch this stuff.
You were trying to make the
Yeah, I think it was MPPP was the target molecule, but it's just was way too easy to screw it up and make MPTP.
Right. There's like a competing elimination reaction.
Right.
Yeah. It's scary. I mean, I'm thankful that as terrible as that is, that does not seem to be a common occurrence, that there is a horrendously potent neurotoxin that can easily be produced as a side product of a synthesis.
Yeah, but you know, but you never know when something funky like that may be at the other end of a synthesis that you're just trying for the first time.
Right.
I mean, whoever was making this stuff had no idea what he might make something that would turn people into these paralyzed mannequins.
Of course not. No. Yeah. I mean, he didn't even know that he made this error in the synthesis. Sure. So you became addicted to methadone, you detoxed, you lost your job, then what?
Well, I had been going to graduate school at night, and I went back to Connecticut from New Jersey, and I started to go to graduate school at University of Connecticut. And more, I started doing research into this same kind of stuff that I used to, but more so into the supplement side of things, because I had an idea for nutritional supplements that no one even conceived of. And I really thought to myself that I would love to get a job where I can market some of this stuff and maybe even get back to synthesizing some of these steroids that no one has ever heard of that have much higher activity on paper. Because I know that people go crazy over that stuff. And I was on the internet at the burgeoning of social media, which back then there was something called Usenet news groups.
Right.
Very awkward form. But I would throw out little teasers about stuff that I've learned, and people were like, whoa, what's he talking about? Who is this guy? And that's where I piqued the interest of Dan Duchesne, who at the time was known as the steroid guru. He had written a book called The Underground Steroid Handbook. And I started to correspond with him, and I ended up doing some research for him, and he'd use it in his articles to look really smart. He would just put in the layman's terms of some of the things I told him. But I eventually got a job at this. I left graduate school. I got pretty much all my coursework done towards a PhD, but you know, I never got into the thesis part of it. And I went to work at a company called EAS, which is a very big company. And they were just starting to grow really big at the time. And I was the director of science research for 2 weeks. I left. And I got fired. I didn't. But my ideas and plans were way too sophisticated for what they wanted for me. So then I went back home and eventually ran into somebody that knew somebody out here. And it's a long story. I don't want to waste too much time about that, but it was a very strange hookup that I had. And with a guy out here, I had nothing to do with fitness industry, nothing to do with steroids, but he, you know, was interested in any business idea. And he ended up being the perfect fit for me because I was allowed to kind of build a lab here.
Wow.
And he was able to buy used equipment. And then we had a machine shop where we were able to modify that equipment to do reactions on a pilot or manufacturing scale. And that was the basic, that was the foundation of our business. And later on, we got our own supplement line and all sorts of things. We ventured into other stuff too.
And what I find interesting about this as well is with most psychoactive drugs, no one is even thinking about using them as supplements. There's some exceptions, of course. You know, you have kava and kratom and things like that that are plant-based. But if I discover some new dopamine reuptake inhibitor, there's no way that I'm going to, you know, say, oh, this would make a great supplement, because I just know from a regulatory perspective, there would be no way to get away with it and it would be dangerous. What made you think that you could do that with steroids? Like, was it just easier? Were there no regulations? Are there still no regulations? Can you just come up with a new steroid and sell it? I actually just don't know.
No. This was in 1994, a law was passed called the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act. And that really opened up the supplement industry for novel compounds. It was very vaguely written, and it could be interpreted as anything that's naturally occurring could be sold as a supplement. And I knew at the time that DHEA was being sold as a supplement. It was being sold as a supplement around 96. And my first idea was, okay, well, that's a steroid, albeit it's not very effective as far as anabolic activity, but you know, it's two hydrogen atoms or minus two hydrogen atoms away from androstenedione, which is direct precursor to testosterone. So I figured, well, androstenedione is not controlled. It's naturally occurring or present in animals, so it's present in food, hypothetically. Well, I mean, it is, but not certainly at very small amounts. So I decided to test the market with that through another guy, and there was no reaction from authorities. Actually, I thought that there was going to be. I didn't know how things were going to end up. And then I went on to introduce another testosterone precursor, which was even better, which was a 4-androstenediol. And then other people started to get into this whole, and it was called prohormones because they were precursors to actual active hormones, in this case, testosterone. And then other people came up with other prohormones like androstenedione. And then I finally came up with just one androstenediol based upon a very obscure metabolite, androgen metabolite, that was quite potent. One testosterone was very potent steroid. And I developed the precursors to that, the prohormones to that. And that ended up, we finally settled upon one androstenediol, which was known as 1-AD. And that was a very effective product. I mean, it was up there with a lot of traditional anabolic steroids. And that made my company a lot of money. I worked very hard in that synthesis. It was not easy at all, but it perfected it and it just flew off the shelves. So that was good. We built a large facility in another part of town and so on and so forth till everything changed. Well, eventually.
And you say it made a lot of money. So what was this? It was a pill that was being sold?
Yeah, capsules. I think it was 100 milligrams per capsule of one androstenediol.
And did it have a brand name or what? This is supplement shops?
We trademarked the name 1-AD, and that was a very easily remembered name. And people still come up to me and say, oh man, 1-AD, that stuff, it took on a life of its own. It's got kind of a legendary status. Of course, in 2005, it was made illegal. I just made it turn into a controlled substance, as were most all prohormones at that time. But there were loopholes and people went on to sell other stuff that weren't even natural, outright synthetic steroids. And it was pretty ridiculous. But eventually they clamped down on that so hard that no one dares sell anything of that variety now.
And this could be due to my general ignorance of the industry, but I've always found the regulation of steroids kind of weird. It always seemed like, you know, from the typical war on drugs, Nixon, Reagan era drug scare, people really cared about psychoactive drugs. And seeing anabolic steroids lumped in as controlled substances always seemed a little weird to me. Do you know how that even came about? I mean,
yeah.
When did that become a concern for the, was it ever a conceivable public health risk beyond long-term effects of continuous use among athletes?
The criteria, as you know, for something to be scheduled means has to have one of two things or both. It has to have addiction potential. And a lot of people thought steroids had addiction potential. They may have psychological addictive potential, like marijuana does, but probably even less so than marijuana. But it also has to be a danger, a public health risk. And yes, you could abuse them. And yes, they can have toxicity associated with them. Certainly not, you're not going to overdose like you would with opioids or anything like that. But the reason why they got attention like they did, and there was such a push to make them controlled, to schedule them, was because of all the stuff that I referred to earlier that culminated in Ben Johnson being stripped of his medal and people being outraged that steroids were such a game changer in sports and that they completely ruined the level playing field, that they had to be, that was the first and foremost reason why. And then they came up with it, you know, they're toxic and yeah, they're addictive too. But it was a pretty easy thing to do. And it did. In 1989, a bill was passed. In 1990, it was signed into law, and it was the Anabolic Steroid Control Act. And they were made Schedule 3, which is trying to think of other Schedule 3 compounds. Maybe benzodiazepines are Schedule 3A. I don't remember.
Yeah, they are. And ketamine is as well.
Ketamine. Okay. Yeah. Well, that has, yeah, it's medical. Obviously, it has medical utility. But they left out, they did have like a catch-all in there. And there is the Analog Act. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Being, I certainly am. Yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't apply to Schedule 3. So that's one reason why I was able to do what I did and not have it automatically pinpointed or listed as an analog.
Right.
And so eventually they had another Anabolic Steroid Control Act updated version, and they made the same damn mistake as before. They just added more compounds, but they didn't add all of them. And then it became a joke. And now they have like a catch-all phrase saying that if it's marketed for muscle growth or something like that, then it's considered, and it has a steroid structure, then it's considered an anabolic steroid by administrative action, blah, blah, blah. And that kind of shut people down from coming up with new analogs, because you can't sell something unless you say, oh, it builds muscle. You know, you just can't put the steroid out there and say, hey, I got this. I'm not going to tell you what it does. It doesn't work.
Right, 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 right. So you had this blockbuster compound and made a lot of money from it. And where did you go from there?
Well, one really interesting part of my experience, which is probably one of the things I'm most well known for, is while I was doing all this stuff through my business, the pro hormone stuff, I was also manufacturing highly, wholly synthetic steroid derivatives that could evade drug tests. And there were three compounds that I came up with. One of them had been synthesized before, and I almost made it to market, or did very briefly, and that was called merbolathone. However, it was not on the list of stuff that they tested for, and I knew that it didn't share any metabolites with anything that was on the list. So I started to sell that to athletes and trainers, and they would use it and pass drug tests, and which would give them a huge advantage over other people that didn't have access to that technology. And I later on went on to actually make a new chemical entity, a completely new compound called tetrahydrogesterone, which I synthesized from an endometriosis drug.
Right. Clear.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how testing is done under these circumstances, but I assume they collect urine from the athlete and then they run GCMS on the urine sample. Is that correct?
Well, they collect urine. They isolate out the fractions that would contain steroids, and they do a derivatization to make the steroids more volatile. And then they run them through GC mass spec. However, if the compound that you made is not on their list and their computer program is not tuned to pick up that compound and or its metabolites, then it's going to not be seen, because they're testing thousands and thousands of stuff of urine samples. So no one is going to, no one analytical chemist is going to look at every test. It's going to be automated like that.
And I see.
The clear had a very unique property to it, and that after derivatization, due to its chemical structures, its high degree of conjugated double bonds, in addition to an ethyl group right next to a hydroxyl group that is then derivatized by, I think it's turned into a triflate, a protecting group, that was put into the GC mass spec, and it just flew apart, disintegrated.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so that not only was it not picked up in a program that would look for specific compounds, but even if it was, it just would disintegrate. So eventually they had to switch to liquid chromatography mass spectrometry, which, as you know, run in solvents and doesn't use high heat and vacuum. And they were able to come up with a method to detect it. But the guy that was head of the UCLA lab that did, discovered that tetrahydrogesterone was being used, because somebody snitch gave sent him a syringe of the stuff.
What snitch?
Oh, his name was Trevor Graham. He was Marion Jones' coach and Tim Montgomery. They were sprinters or track and field athletes. And they had a falling out with the guy I was working with in San Francisco. His name was Victor Conti. And when they had a falling out, they sent a sample of this stuff to the lab because Victor was going to shut them off from access to it. So it was tragic, stupid stuff. But he noticed that it did. So they actually characterized it from the little sample of the stuff in oil and reverse engineered it and made it and then put it through their protocol of testing using derivatization techniques. And he noticed that it just did not show up at all. And he thought that I had engineered it to do that, which is kind of funny because Bob Costas came to interview me once. And part of that interview, he talked to Don Catlin, who was head of the lab. And Don's like, well, I usually don't like to call someone that works for the other side brilliant, but this compound was really, I was like, well, you believe what you want, but I didn't expect to disintegrate.
Right. And out of curiosity, do any of these compounds have interest? I mean, is it like colored or anything? Do the conjugated double bonds give it an interesting color?
The clear or the tetrahydrogestinone had three double bonds that were conjugated, and they were also conjugated to a ketone group. And yeah, they were yellow in color because of that, you know, the delocalization and the electrons and everything that has to do with light absorption. And trenbolone is also an anabolic steroid that's available. It's mostly used in animals, and that's also yellow. Because anything with high conjugation is going to be not white. And the more conjugation, the further down the electromagnetic spectrum of visible color you're going to get, as you know.
That's really interesting. I mean, when people talk about steroids, it's almost always in terms of their androgenic activity, but I'm also curious about off-target effects. I mean, there's obviously this concept of roid rage and the idea that some steroids exert some kind of psychoactive effect. I mean, have you noticed any steroids that have potent psychoactive properties?
Yes, there are some that kind of stand out in that regard. And it's more like they make you very irritable and kind of little impulsive. And at the same time, you hyper-focused and vigilant. And ones that stand out to me are halotestin or fluoxymesterone, trenbolone's one as well, Anadrol, which is also well known for its water retention effects. That one can have a psychological effect on you. And there was one that was made that was called methyl 1 test that was really bad in that regard. And it also, I don't think this has ever been demonstrated, but that stuff was so strange that you would take it and you would gain so much water weight. I thought that maybe it interfered or maybe it had a cross affinity for mineral corticoid receptors, which would have resulted in sodium and water retention. But yeah, that stuff would make you feel like you're going to have a heart attack while climbing the stairs. But at the same time, your strength just went absolutely insane.
Well, that's what I wondered is, you know, when I would read about anabolic steroid associated aggression, I wondered if it would be possible to disentangle the influence of getting muscular, because that in and of itself seems like it could cause some behavioral psychological changes that could be mistaken for psychoactivity. Like if you are bigger and stronger and more threatening, could that in and of itself change your confidence in the way that you interact with other people because you feel more dangerous, essentially?
Yeah, I've always believed that to be the case. And you have to disassociate that from any direct effects a steroid might have on the brain. And the only way you could do that is by giving these compounds to somebody and also giving a placebo to another cohort, or just giving it to someone and telling them it's something else and not having them work out or do anything. And then if they exhibit aggressive tendencies, then you know it's a direct effect on the brain and not secondary to feeling suddenly enabled and hyper masculine.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and of course, there are also neurosteroids that are conventional psychoactive drugs. I think it was just 2 years ago that the FDA approved allopregnanolone for treatment of postpartum depression. Is that an area you ever investigated?
Yeah. Yes, I have. I made allopregnanolone. It's kind of difficult. It is not orally active, and it is active parenterally. However, you still need a lot of milligrams. But there have been synthetic derivatives of allopregnanolone, which inhibit the metabolic deactivation of the compound by, you know, putting a methyl group adjacent to a hydroxyl group and turning it from a secondary to a tertiary hydroxyl, which then cannot be oxidized. And then that extends the lifetime. Then it has to be metabolized via other methods. And I've read some research on some of these derivatives, but I didn't know that allopregnanolone itself was approved. I don't know how they deliver it, because you really need a pretty massive amount to get that GABA-A enhancement effect.
Yeah, it's my understanding that it's administered as an IV infusion.
Yeah, that would make sense. And probably for acute effects, maybe anti-seizure. I don't really know.
Did you achieve any interesting effects from it? Did you find it relaxing?
I did. Yeah, I mean, I felt like, you know, like someone gave me Versed. I forgot the name of that benzo. It begins with midazolam.
Yeah.
It was very transient, but quite noticeable.
Right. Were there any other neurosteroids that you investigated?
No, but DHEA is known to be a neurosteroid. It actually has an antagonistic effect upon the affinity of the GABA-A receptor to GABA. So it does the opposite of the progesterone metabolites. And I wonder if some of the anabolic steroids that seem to have a marked effect more so than the other ones on psychology, I wonder if they don't have direct actions in the brain via GABA receptors also. I'm not sure. But there are many steroids that are quite anabolic that actually make you quite mellow, like dianabol. People generally report feeling quite good on it and not aggressive at all. So it's not a black and white area.
Right. And it seems that the industry now has moved away from steroids toward SARMs, and that has created a whole new world. I imagine that you have investigated those as well.
Yeah. So professor here in town developed one of the SARMs, and a chemical company here in town that I'm familiar with, that our friend Justin Kirkland actually worked for a while. He was a salesman there.
Yeah, Justin Kirkland, I met him one time at a conference and he seemed extremely interesting. He is very much involved with psychoactive compounds. How do you know him?
Well, he actually lived in the town Seymour, a very, very tiny town where my lab started. And he knew that I was there. He was a chemist. And at one time he just came over and said hi. And then he disappeared. And then he reappeared at that Obiter Research in town, which is a chemical company that does custom synthesis. And he was a salesman there, and they actually helped us out with some syntheses. So I got to know him through business, and eventually he left over to research and went on his own, and he needed a lab. And I said, well, you can share the lab with me since it's an empty desk here. And he had a bunch of glassware and other things that he contributed to the lab. And he stayed there for about 2 years. He would travel, come back. He didn't really do a whole lot of work in the lab. He didn't do any lab work. He said he was going to, but he didn't really do that. But he was more a salesman guy. He just definitely had the gift of gab when it came to sales. And I think he has landed himself quite decent position working for a Canadian chemical company that is going to embark upon manufacturing MDMA and eventually LSD.
Was that Cybin?
But I know that they have a license from the government, or they have something like that. And all, you know, he sent a whole list of these psychedelic compounds that they're going to try to synthesize. And they're going to be used for research around the world, and eventually maybe to be used clinically for actual patients if they get approved somewhere. So he's got a very interesting job. I wish I can go work with him, do some of the synthesis, but I have a felony background through the Belco thing, which I mentioned earlier, and I can't go to Canada. Well, his place is in Canada.
And so tell me about that. So this was associated with the CLEAR.
Yeah. Yes, eventually the drug testers caught up with Victor Conti, who was one of the trainers that I was selling this stuff to. And he had a big mouth, and he worked with very, very high profile athletes. And one of them was Barry Bonds, and a IRS agent had been after Barry Bonds for quite a while for tax evasion. And he stumbled into Victor Conti, and then it changed from tax evasion to this investigation of supplying steroids and other things to athletes, Barry being the primary one that this guy was interested into. But it just exploded into a huge, huge scandal. And it made all the sports pages. It was in all the sports news for a long time. And I was the guy that made the undetectables. So I was considered a huge target. And other people got caught in 2003, but it took 2 years for them to actually raid my place or the business that I was in, that I owned. And by that time, all evidence of anything was gone. But nevertheless, I was indicted and convicted, and I had to go to prison for a period of time. And so I have a felony conviction, which has caused me a lot of troubles.
How long were you in prison?
Just 3 months.
And the crime that you committed was what? I mean, what were you charged with?
It was something I wasn't guilty of. But they said he's got to plead guilty to it anyway, because what I was selling were compounds that were not controlled. Because we had that discussion before, where Schedule III substances are not bound by the Analog Act. So right. I was not, there was no distribution of controlled substances, of anabolic steroids. But the lead prosecutor said that I had to plead guilty to that anyway, because of the case being so high profile, and any other crime that they can come up with would be very minor felonies or misdemeanors. So I pled guilty to that. There was no point in fighting on the wrath of the federal government. And at that time, they would have done anything to nail me. So I just said, okay, just be nice to me. So I got 3 months and some house arrest, no fines.
And so they were saying that the Clear was a controlled substance when it wasn't. I mean, were they
exactly? Exactly. And my attorney had written like a huge dossier, whatever you want to call it, explaining why what I sold was not a felony in the context of the Controlled Substance Act. And the prosecutor said, well, Rick, you know, you make a very good point. It's all well and good, but Patrick is going to have to plead guilty to this felony regardless, because that's the only way we're going to have it. And he does not have the means to fight this, nor do is it a wise thing for him to do so.
What a nightmare.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a big surprise that they took that stance.
But I mean, it's just completely unfair. So, I mean, they didn't charge you with a different drug. They just said this uncontrolled substance that you were distributing is controlled, and we're just going to pretend that is the case, and you pled guilty.
Yes. And actually, there were three versions of the Clear. And the third one, which had never really reached never got into the hands of athletes, was listed on there. And after I pled guilty, some people started selling that as a supplement. I mean, even though I was charged with a felony for selling, for just manufacturing it and selling it in very small amounts, people sold it as a supplement and until 2005, when that was added to the list of controlled substances. It's craziness. It was arbitrary, and I was just a victim of the incredible exposure that this case had all around the world.
And it's my understanding that the Clear was not a commercially available substance. Is that correct?
No, that's correct. And it never was. I mean, I was the first person, if you look in the literature, this stuff had never even been synthesized before. I was the first person to synthesize it. But I knew from its chemical structure and similarity to other steroids, it was kind of like a hybrid between two very potent steroids. And it ended up being very potent in its own right.
So how did this get into the hands of Barry Bonds?
Well, I was I was selling to a lot of people, athletes and to a lot of trainers. And one of them was this guy, Victor Conti, who had a place in San Francisco. He had a supplement, a mineral supplement. And he liked to hobnob with all the big athletes. And he would always get some kind of an advertisement or article in Flex magazine, or he was big in the bodybuilding scene. He had all these famous athletes coming in and out of his facility. He would do all this blood work on them and say, you're deficient in this mineral, that. And then he was like, okay, I got this program of drugs for you to take. And at the center of the program was the undetectable steroids. He also gave him growth hormone, insulin, thyroid, a variety of other things.
And I also imagine that you were not the only person doing this. I mean, it's certainly assumed that in many of these professional athletic spheres, everybody is using something. I mean, is that an exaggeration?
Is using something, but they're using stuff that everyone knows, stuff that is out there that you can get. One of them was methyltrienolone, which was a drug that you could get from China. And people would take it in very tiny amounts, but they'd have to go off of it. No one else was making anabolic steroid analogs that were undetectable. I was the only one. And I don't know of anyone that has ever done it since either. I mean, I had everyone in the world coming to me if they knew about me. And there was no one else in the world doing this. Such a limited fashion that didn't really make a big difference.
I mean, I find this very interesting. So could you give me an example? Like, would some Olympic coach say, send me a vial of, could you go into detail about how it works? I understand it's like somewhat incriminating.
At the time, my lab was in a small town named Seymour, and I would synthesize it. I would synthesize gram quantities, and then I would dissolve it either in an oil or propylene glycol at a certain concentration, and I would put it in a nondescript bottle, and I'd ship it off to whoever. In the case of the guy that got me in trouble, who worked with the famous athletes, I would ship it to San Francisco, to Victor Conti. And then he would take it and then put it into his tiny little vials and say that it was his own invention or whatever. I don't give a damn. But then he would give it to all these athletes and they would reap the benefits.
And they knew what was going on as well. There was no pretense that this is a...
Well, I have no idea what Victor said to him. I knew he would say words like, yo, this is the clear, this is... I think he told him it was a steroid, but... Only a few people around him knew that he was getting it from someone, a chemist out there. And he would try to treat me as this mystery man that only Victor had connections with him. Where in reality, I was selling to people in Europe, and I could get into some wild stories about I was selling to the people that Victor's athletes were competing against. Yeah, actually, Marion Jones ended up getting her gold medal taken away because they found out she was taking one of the clears in 2000. And the woman that came in second place was from a country on the Mediterranean. I don't want to divulge anything, but she was taking it too. And she was awarded, she got the silver. And when Marianne was stripped of the gold, she ended up with the gold. So it's funny that the good anti-doping administration thought they were righting a wrong when the person that took that was given the gold was also did the same violation.
Wow. Is that publicly known?
Like, if you read between the lines, people know. I've mentioned in another podcast, I wasn't as coy in my description. I came right out and said it, but it's not publicly known to the general public. And I don't try to, I only mention it on these podcasts like this that I don't think any, you know, it's not going to go on ESPN or anything like that.
Right.
So
but that's pretty amazing to think that Marion Jones was stripped of her gold and then it was given to somebody who was using the same drug.
Correct. And I have a lot of stories like that.
And was the issue that Marion Jones admitted to having used it, or was she caught?
Oh, she ended up getting, I don't remember exactly how. I don't think they had a sample of her urine. I think it came down to where she was forced to admit it. I don't quite remember how she was caught, but she was vehemently denying to the press and to Oprah. And eventually when she got caught, she went back on Oprah and was like, I'm so sorry, but I'm a better person now. Everyone's like, oh, Marion, it's okay. It was disgusting.
I think the overarching question with all of this is, if everybody's doing it and it's just a question of who's getting away with it, what do you think the appropriate regulatory strategy would be?
Well, in the case of Olympic sports, the regulatory body would be the World Anti-Doping Association and its affiliates in other countries, like in the United States, it's the United States Anti-Doping Administration. They have to take a zero tolerance approach. Now, you're right, it's at least at the upper echelons, it's a battle of chemistry. However, what I did with by making these undetectable analogs available, it sort of changed playing field, because everyone was sort of doing the same stuff with detectable things and just taking them at certain dosages and getting off them at the same time. But with my stuff, the people that had access to them had a decidedly big advantage over people that were using their old techniques. So when you say everyone's doing the same thing, that wasn't exactly the case once my stuff got on the scene in sports.
Right. But I mean, in terms of a regulatory strategy, do you think that it would make more sense to allow people to use whatever sort of chemical enhancement they want? Do you think it should be free for all, where this is something that is just at the discretion of the athlete, in the same way that the specifics of their exercise routines are at their own discretion?
I don't have an answer for that. And if you don't advocate acceptable use, then how the hell do you do that? I mean, you say, okay, you could use, but you can't use too much. And then how do you avoid the terrible message that you're going to send to amateur athletes in school, elementary school, high school? Say, okay, well, they allow these athletes to take drugs, so I guess drugs aren't that bad. So why can't we take drugs in high school? It's one of those dilemmas that I think the only way, and it's certainly not the best way or a good way, is for these anti-doping associations to just have a zero tolerance policy. And they do, but if they go beyond that, they're almost aggressively trying to catch people, and people with actual legitimate excuses, they get shot down in arbitration. I know many people that got screwed by them. They almost have a hatred for athletes in a way, and a hatred for drug use. So, but that's not my concern. You know, I'm not a trainer of Olympic athletes. I'm just a chemist.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't have an answer to the question either. And I certainly understand what you're saying, that if you make it a free for all, then the results could be dangerous. People might start dying. Young athletes could develop unhealthy habits. That all makes sense. But to maintain a true zero tolerance policy also seems like it will be difficult, because of people like you, people that are interested in discovering new things and pushing the boundaries and in finding new and interesting loopholes, which I, by the way, think is valuable. I'm not saying that in a critical way.
Well, someone like me would not be in trouble with the law of the land, you know, the feds or anything like that. What we're talking about here is are the people that police the athletes. And it's, you got to figure this, you're talking two different things. Now, not that I would ever, or I think there are any undetectable steroids left, but if you were to make one, why would you make an undetectable steroid unless you had designs to give them to athletes to beat drug tests? And in that case, you're going to piss off the drug testers, who also have a huge lobby in Washington. And what will end up happening is that you'll have to plead guilty to controlled substance. It's like I did, because you just pissed the people off, pissed the government off so much that, no, I mean, the rules, they'll bend the rules to get you.
Right. I actually, when people ask me questions about, you know, what they should do with various drugs, I always find it somewhat obnoxious, like in that I don't want to be responsible for advising other people in terms of what they should do. But could I ask you some questions about that sort of thing? Or is that just
You can. That's not what I do. That's not really my gig. I mean, I know enough about what people take and how long they take them and what doses, but I'm not a trainer. I've never really trained a bodybuilder. Girl I dated did, but that was a long time ago. Hey, you can ask me anything, but I'm certainly not the authority. And it's kind of, I mean, I have a very unique and specialized set of skills and knowledge, and you're asking me pretty pedestrian questions. But if you want to,
that's the point, is that you're very knowledgeable and I trust your opinion on these things. But yeah, it's a basic question, but curious.
You have to understand, just because I understand the chemistry of these and the pharmacology of them on a more sophisticated medical level, does not mean that I am an expert or the only expert or any kind of on the casual use of them for bodybuilding purposes. That's more right. That's more of an art actually than a science.
Yeah. Because if you look on forums, there's this proliferation of conflicting advice about how to use various SARMs or various supplements. And because most of the scientific literature is oriented toward treatment of disease, it becomes difficult to find authoritative advice or authoritative information about how a healthy person could responsibly use a steroid in order to better their life in some relatively innocuous way.
Yeah, that's my any scientific study on the use of anabolic steroids to build muscle in a healthy exercising individual would be ethically unsound and would never occur.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So let's say, for example, somebody wants to, you know, they're not a professional athlete, they're not a bodybuilder, but they want to gain some muscle mass without damaging their tendons or doing anything bad. What is the kind of, do you think SARMs are like the state of the art? No.
Actually, SARMs are kind of dropped out of the picture. They never got too far in clinical trials and the drug development pipeline. And I think the pharmaceutical companies have given up on them because they just ran into the same problems that were apparent with anabolic steroids, the same toxicities and everything. I mean, it was a great noble endeavor to use drug design, receptor ligand interaction software, and to map expression of genes involved in the anabolic response and the androgenic response, much more sophisticated than any stuff they used in the development of anabolic steroids. But they ended up not really making much improvements on the technology. You just can't seem to differentiate the side effects or the virilizing effects from the muscle building effects or the toxic effects.
Right. So do you think a sort of conventional course of oxandrolone with some PCT and maybe, how do you feel about co-administering finasteride to avoid hair loss? Do you think that that's a dangerous path or that will?
No. I mean, if you are susceptible to androgenic alopecia or male pattern baldness and you were to take testosterone, you might want to take finasteride so that the DHT conversion at the scalp is blocked. However, it would only work with testosterone or with steroids that are very similar to testosterone. A lot of steroids aren't, and they do not undergo 5-alpha reduction to more potent androgens. Like, for instance, nandrolone, if you took finasteride with that, you would actually have the reverse effect. It would actually make it more of a issue with male pattern baldness. It would actually stimulate the destruction of follicles.
Okay, so back to the pedestrian question, if you would be so kind to answer it. I mean, what do you think would be the kind of entry-level way to go about this based on everything that currently exists?
This is assuming a perfect world where you can just go to your pharmacy and, hey, I would like some exandrolone.
Yeah. Assuming a perfect world. Assuming, forget legality, forget everything.
I would just get a testosterone and take that. And it's the natural hormone. And if you're a man, take testosterone at 250 milligrams a week. If you want to go beyond that, then you could add other things into it. But I don't think there's any magic mix of steroids that's going to do anything more than just break your wallet. And not everyone is looking to win a bodybuilding contest. So I don't see why you should be too elaborate or sophisticated with it. Just take something basic, like testosterone. And if you want to take something else with that, take growth hormone with that. But be careful and make sure that your blood sugar is under control. Testosterone and growth hormone is about as good as you're going to get, really. And it's probably about as safe as you're going to get because you won't be taking anything oral.
Right.
Disappointed you. I don't have a magic stack of all Winstrol and Anadrol and Masteron and Deca. No. And you want to go that route, you're just going to end up wasting a lot of money and injecting yourself a bunch of times when you don't have to.
Right. And then I'm also very interested in stimulants. This is an area that I have done a lot of chemistry related to, and you are equally famous for methylhexanamine. This is like an immensely popular supplement. Could you tell me the story of how you developed that or how you rediscovered it?
I rediscovered it. I just stumbled across it. I don't remember what I was looking for, but I was just going through hundreds and hundreds of abstracts. And I just saw something Russian and they mentioned this compound and they mentioned something to do with norepinephrine level increases. And I said, well, that might be something interesting to look into because ephedrine had just been banned. So there was a big vacuum in the pre-workout fat loss supplement area of the supplement market. So I ended up finding someone that sold this stuff as a research chemical. And I bought some and I put it in little caplets and gave it to some people. And they said, wow, this stuff is great. And I was like, interesting. I looked at the structure and I noticed that the structure was sort of, it had like the side chain of
amphetamine.
Yeah. But instead of having a phenyl group at the end of it, it had a little alkyl branch chain alkyl group, ethyl methyl, whatever. So yeah, it definitely had some structural similarities to amphetamine, but it didn't quite have the same feel as amphetamine. I think it may have been more of a norepinephrine uptake or reuptake inhibitor type of thing. And then I don't think it had the dopamine effect that amphetamine does, which is a good thing because that is what ends up making you a little psycho and ends up making it addicting.
And I remember around the time that I met Stephen Watt, there was a supplement that had just hit the market called Craze, and it was immensely popular. And I bought a sample of it. I tried it. And I really liked the effect. I brought it to the lab and I found it difficult to analyze because it contained so much junk. There were like vitamins mixed in and all these different additives and flavor agents and colors. And it was, you know, attempting to separate all the different components was so tedious that I didn't have time for it. And I remember thinking, okay, well, I don't know, maybe it is some kind of orchid extract that is really responsible for this. And then it came out that it was the alpha ethyl and ethyl phenethylamine. And that was an immensely popular compound as well. So it seems like there is a huge demand for these stimulant pre-workout products.
Yeah, that was, you could basically call it it was definitely an amphetamine in its structure, ethyls instead of methyls at alpha and on the nitrogen atom. Now, I had extracted the product Craze also, and I ran the extract through the GC mass spec, and I got some very distinct peaks. And one of them, you know, I was really curious about, but I couldn't figure out exactly what its structure was. And its molecular weight I could figure out because the M plus ion was apparent, but I didn't feel like going into all the fragmentation and doing all that work to unravel what it is. But someone else that eventually did that work, and it was that peak that I saw that was the amphetamine analog that you just mentioned. And that was put in there. That was not a constituent of any extract. That was quite obviously a synthetic product that was put in there on purpose to get this desired effect. And I didn't do stuff like that. I mean, the DMAA or methoxanamine, whatever you want to call it, I based that upon an article that it was found in geranium oil. It gives some justification for its sale as a supplement. But to spike something with a wholly synthetic amphetamine analog, and then say, oh, it's a secret constituent of, I don't even remember what.
It's an orchid.
Or some kind of an orchid, yeah.
Dendrobium.
That's the easy way out. You know, that's criminal, in my opinion. Because then how am I supposed to compete with that?
Yeah. Did you continue working with stimulants or was?
I found another analog of DMAA that was natural. And I put it in a product, and within a few weeks, I got a call from this guy, Ron Kramer, who said he heard from this guy, Oliver Catlin, who's the son of Don Catlin, who I mentioned about the guy at the UCLA lab that had added up to doping testing. He said, we know what Patrick is selling now. And it just scared me. I stopped selling it. But it worked almost as well as DMAA. But I'm like, you know, I'm not going to be able to ever sell a damn stimulant ever again, because they'll come after me. Because I'm just a target, because they know I'm clever enough to come up with these things that pisses them off. So as soon as I come up with something new, someone like this, the Catlin guy, is going to take it. He's going to analyze it. He's going to figure out what it is. And then he's going to call the FDA and say, do something about this. Stop Patrick. So I'm not even in it designing. I mean, I don't even have a business anymore right now. I'm kind of looking for the next thing for me to do. It's kind of difficult with a felony background, but I would like to get back into chemistry. If I can't do that, then perhaps I can do some technical writing or something, but I don't know what the kind of hard finding any interest.
I'm probably wrong about this, but I would think that people would be sympathetic to the specific nature of your felony. I mean, this is a felony that occurred in the context of valuable research. Is that still a deterrent for supplement companies? I'm surprised that they would care.
There are no supplement companies out there. First of all, none of them manufacture their own ingredients. Second of all, it is impossible to come out with any novel ingredients now, unless you are way under the radar and you sell off to Facebook or something. The FDA has made it completely impossible to introduce new dietary ingredients.
Well, I imagine there's also, in fact, I know that there is a big industry for research chemicals, for SARMs and these various peptides. Is that something that you ever wanted to get involved with? I mean, fully gray market.
I'm not a peptide chemist. And plus, there are dozens of labs out there that have peptide synthesizers that are already cranking these things out. I don't know anyone that would, I don't know what I could make that would be of, I don't know, to tell you the truth. And it would have to be someone that doesn't have a problem hiring a felon. There are the things I also owe the government quite a bit of money from a separate issue that was also complete BS, and my wages be garnished, but or not.
What would you be working on if you could? I mean, assuming that these barriers didn't exist, what would be your next target if you had the freedom to pursue what you wanted?
What would I synthesize? What kind of thing would I synthesize? I have no idea. I'd have to do, well, first of all, I'd nothing that would be sold as a supplement. And second of all, what do you have any ideas? I don't know.
Well, I'm just curious where this industry is heading. It seems.
What industry?
The supplement industry. I mean, obviously.
Well, as I told you, can't introduce any new dietary ingredients.
Well, the gray market one. It seems that there's a ton. I mean, they're even advertising openly on Instagram and social media. There's no question that there's a huge industry.
Yeah, the gray market people, they buy finished products from China. I don't think that they have a fully equipped lab to do chemical synthesis that I could waltz on into and start making stuff. The gray market by nature is a very small market, and they don't have the money to support chemical manufacturing facilities. So though I appreciate your throwing out suggestions out there. I've given this ample thought, and I don't really know a solution. I haven't figured it out yet, but I'll find something.
I mean, you're a legend. I would think that there's a lot of people that would be excited to work with you, but yeah.
Well, maybe someone has a lab in Mexico. I could do crazy things down there.
I'm sure. I mean, I never thought I'd be in a position where I could make psychedelics all day as a job. And that became
possible. Well, you're at the right place at the right time. I missed out on a whole psychedelic thing. It's too bad, but I wish you the best of luck at that. And Justin's, he's on the vanguard of that as well.
And in terms of, you know, the pedestrianness of the questions, are there things from a chemistry perspective or more technical things that you think would be interesting to discuss that you're typically not asked about? Because I do imagine you get a lot of the same questions. Is there something on the chemistry side that you think is cool that listeners should be aware of? It could be, you know, technical aspects of synthesis that you developed or anything really.
I'm drawing a blank, man. I mean, you want to get into it?
I had one question though. You mentioned that it was like one of the steroids had a hot flavor, like a spicy, like capsaicin type effect.
Yeah, that was one testosterone and the precursors thereof. And could never figure that out. At first, I thought it was an impurity, but no, I mean, you could purify that stuff to the nth degree, and it still has a very irritating burning sensation that lasted quite a while on the mouth. And it would ask, and if you took too much, it could also cause a little bit of stomach distress. I don't know. I mean, it's just like what we were talking about before. You make a new chemical and you just don't know what activities it may have beyond the intended activities. It could be something completely unpredictable. So there must be some sort of receptors in mucous membranes that cause this irritation, hot sensation.
Right. And it's like a capsaicin type heat, like a spicy heat or more of a...
That's the closest I could describe it, is capsaicin-like, but a little bit different. It could be the same family of receptors as capsaicin. That's a distinct possibility. Certainly doesn't have a structure even remotely related to capsaicin, which I'm sure has a nitrogen in it, as most of these active botanical compounds do.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Well, is there any work that you'd want people to see, or anything I can direct listeners to that might help you out in some way? Or, you know, I don't know if you have a website or any products that you, or anything that could help you out.
Not at the moment. Let me talk to my ex-partners. I think that they're going to start selling some prototype nutrition products. I don't know how quickly they can get that going, or even how to buy them. I'm supposed to talk to someone that's going to make a website for me, but that's going to be sometime in the future. I wish I had something to pitch so I could get some value out of it. Well, some people know who I am now, and, you know, maybe someone's like, oh, you know, maybe this guy, you know, maybe he would like to help us out with this or that. And then, you know, I can make some money doing that. I don't know. At least I'm getting out there.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to me.
No problem.
And yeah, I wish you luck and hope you have a good night.